program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Material is selected with the interests of its audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Welcome to Audio Journal's reading of Psychology Today. This broadcast is for informational purposes only, and suggestions should always be discussed with your health care providers. This is Tracy, and today I will start with, this is an article about couples therapy. Is it ever too late for couples therapy? Some differences, conflicts, or behaviors can end a relationship, and some should. But when couples aren't sure of their next move, a skilled therapist can help them find a path to staying together or to moving apart with respect and care. Is couples therapy helpful if things aren't awful yet? Most people's perception of couples therapy is that it's a last resort, the thing you begrudgingly do right before you file for divorce, so you can at least say, "We tried everything." This perception is sometimes correct, but it's actually more common for couples to seek therapy because they want to avoid that scenario. Most couples don't really want to reach the point of last resort. They don't want to get divorced, and they don't want to keep fighting in the same unproductive way, especially in front of others. Problems don't come from nowhere. There's a chance that one or both of you have brewing concerns right now. Perhaps not big enough to make an issue of yet, but concerning enough that they might become disruptive. Or maybe you're both avoiding making a major life decision because you're not in agreement about what to do. Or you have some lingering resentment or hurt from the past that you're trying to ignore so the feelings will go away. Looking back, couples often realize that unearthing and addressing problems, even small ones, early on could have kept them from becoming bigger and more ruinous. People only believe couples therapy is the last nail in the coffin because generally they wait way too long to start it. If you spent 10 years angry at your partner, a few sessions will not fix that. As an analogy, we don't wait for wounds to become infected before treating them. As soon as we realize we're bleeding, we wash the cut and care for it. We ought to do the same for our relationships. When you see a relational wound, treat it right away. It's a lot easier than surgery. From Isabel Morley, a clinical psychologist and author of They're Not Gaslighting You. How can couples therapy help after infidelity? Learning that a spouse has been unfaithful is shattering. A betrayed spouse's mind fills with questions. How could you do this to me? Who was this person? How long has it been going on? What was the sex like? Do you love them? How will I ever be able to trust you again? In the early aftermath, many couples have marathon talk sessions, and the unfaithful spouse is often willing to help the betrayed spouse regain equilibrium. But when the betrayed's need-to-know urge lingers, unfaithful spouses can begin to question the value of continuing to talk about it. After all, it doesn't feel very good. At this juncture, many couples seek professional help. They're looking for direction and a mediator, someone to tell them who's right and who's wrong. After decades of working with couples trying to recover from affairs, I can tell you they're both right. If a betrayed spouse is plagued by unanswered questions, these need to be answered honestly and thoroughly. One of the worst things an unfaithful spouse can do is withhold information. Having it leak out gradually over weeks or months re-traumatizes the betrayed spouse, damaging the rebuilding of trust, sometimes irreparably. And the betrayed spouse needs to assess whether knowing more is actually making them feel better. If the answer is yes, it pays to persist. If the answer is no, because there are now images, flashbacks, and ruminating thoughts, they must find ways to resist the temptation to ask for more. The key, though, is that the betrayed partner gets to determine how long conversations about the affair persist. Answers to questions about the infidelity can be painful for the betrayed spouse to hear. They may feel like lashing out at their partner. While this is understandable, it's not an effective way to encourage honesty and openness. They need to be coached about the importance of expressing appreciation to the unfaithful spouse for sharing uncomfortable details. This fosters collaboration and minimizes the shame unfaithful spouses often feel, which gets in the way of being emotionally available again. It's also important for couples to create times when there is no discussion of the affair, when they can focus on neutral or even pleasant topics and activities. If all you focus on is the pain, it becomes even more challenging to heal. How a therapist navigates this period can greatly affect the outcome. The therapist's job is to help couples deal with the intense feelings surrounding the betrayal. That's it. Even if there are legitimate underlying marital issues that will eventually need to be addressed, they're secondary. And by the way, research suggests that many people who cheat are not unhappy in their marriages. Therapists are often taught that it's important to help people arrive at their own solutions, to figure out what works for them. Generally, this is true. But after betrayal, most couples don't know what to do. And when they talk about it, things can get so charged that their thinking brains go offline. Teaching spouses the specific skills they'll need to help each other and themselves, then, is paramount. Infidelity doesn't always have to be a marriage ender. In fact, after the hard work of mending, many couples find that they're more in love than before. But they needed their therapists to offer concrete suggestions and firm coaching every step of the way. From Michelle Weiner Davis, the director of the Divorce Busting Center in Boulder, Colorado, and Woodstock, Illinois, and founder of divorcebusting.com. Is it ever too late for couples therapy? Not all of your problems are fixable. When you're struggling with a relatively small problem, say you spilled coffee on your laptop, you resign yourself to buying a new one and move on with your life. It's an expense and a hassle, but you handle it. Life is not always that simple. Some problems are more painful and affecting and may seem unfixable, like having a partner who is unfaithful, is chronically depressed, or has seemingly lost all interest in sex. With no apparent solution, it may be tempting to just withdraw and soldier on. But that's a lonely and potentially demoralizing choice, one likely to bring you even more pain as you shoulder the burden alone. You should understand that even if a relationship problem isn't wholly solvable, that doesn't mean you can't find some relief. So often, couples avoid therapy for years because one or both partners see no benefit in talking about their struggles. But avoidance typically makes a bad situation even worse. A wiser approach would be to find ways to begin a dialogue. When emotions run high, it's almost guaranteed that you and your partner are misinterpreting and misunderstanding each other. You're both likely to find false meanings in what is being said and not said, done and not done. This only adds to the drama and confusion. Therapy can alter this path. It helps couples communicate about highly emotional issues in a calmer, safer way. Therapists can help you articulate feelings and concerns you may not yet understand and recognize how powerful feelings in the present may be connected and thus intensified by challenges from your past. Therapists can also teach you how you come across to your partner. It's easy to believe that we are acting one way toward our partner, while in reality, our words, tone, and actions are landing in a very different way. Therapists can also help couples identify compromises that might otherwise not be evident. When emotions run high, we tend to see the world in black and white. Talking it out can help the shades of gray to surface. From Marianne Brandon, PhD, a clinical psychologist, diplomate in sex therapy, author, and lecturer with over 20 years of experience working with couples. She is the author of Monogamy, The Untold Story. What if only one person wants to stay together? When one partner wants to save a relationship, but the other is considering a separation, there may still be a way forward through therapy. Such mixed agenda couples could benefit from a distinct clinical approach. William Dougherty of the University of Minnesota has studied mixed agenda couples and their therapeutic experiences. With one person emotionally out the door and the other clinging to hope, these couples may struggle in therapy aimed at fixing their relationship. In some cases, forcing the leaning out partner to work on the relationship before they're ready could actually put them at higher risk of dropping out altogether. This is where discernment counseling comes in. It's a short-term, structured process for couples on the brink of separation. The goal is not solving problems, but determining whether they can be solved. The leaning in partner is invited to understand the other's pain, while the leaning out partner is asked not to criticize the other. Since the aim is not necessarily to save the couple, but to help each partner find clarity, the only failure is if neither learns anything new. Sessions include time with the couple together, as well as one-on-one time with each partner. Necessary because they may not feel safe enough to fully express their feelings and needs when the other is present, given their fragile state. Dougherty developed this model after his research found that a third of couples considering divorce are mixed agenda, and that many of their eventual separations occur without a thorough understanding of what went wrong or what might have still been possible. Discernment counseling invites partners to consider three paths: the status quo, separation or divorce, or a six-month commitment to traditional couples therapy, during which both partners agree to work on their connection while postponing final decisions. Discernment counseling provides couples a structured pause. The leaning out partner is given space to explore their dissatisfaction and doubts rather than being pressured to stay. And the leaning in partner can gain perspective on their role in the dynamic without falling into pleading or self-blame. The goal is to gain understanding of a couple's story and determine if it's one that either partner truly wants to continue writing. As Dougherty put it, before you end your marriage, be sure you know what it is you're ending. From Jason N. Linder, licensed bilingual Spanish-speaking therapist and AAMFT-approved supervisor, specializing in relationship, trauma, addiction-related, and mindfulness therapies. How can couples therapy help when a partner is experiencing depression? Research shows that relationship distress can be a risk factor for depression. That's not surprising. Clinical depression affects millions of Americans. And as a review of research by Mark Weissman of the University of Colorado in colleagues' notes, nearly a third of married individuals report being in a distressing relationship. The intersection of relationship distress and depression, therefore, may affect a significant number of people. The researchers' review confirmed a significant causal link between relationship distress and future depressive symptoms, and between initial symptoms of depression and future relationship distress. Even controlling for factors such as negative thinking, negative mood, distressing life events, personality, and self-esteem levels, this bidirectional link remains statistically significant. Can couples therapy help partners experiencing the 1-2 punch of relationship stress and depression? Encouraging research that the team reviewed showed that various therapeutic approaches were effective at reducing both. Couples therapy, as tracked in these studies, led to both reduced feelings of intimate relationship distress and of depression in partners randomly assigned to receive treatment, as compared with those in control conditions who did not. One study highlighted by the team showed that up to 3/4 of the relief of a partner's depression could be credited to the easing of a relationship distress through couples therapy. The researchers concluded that couples therapy then could be an important tool for both preventing and treating depression in the public at large. By Madeline A. Fugue, professor of social psychology at Eastern Connecticut State University, whose area of expertise include attraction and romantic relationships. This next article is under the category Friends. It's from Mark Travers, PhD, and it's titled The Number One Habit That Destroys Adult Friendships. Imbalance in give and take can spell serious trouble for a friendship. No healthy friendship operates on a strict 50-50 split at all times. Life happens. There will be seasons when one person gives more, carries more, or needs more. However, there is a significant difference between a temporary imbalance and a structural one. When the same person is always the one reaching out first, always the one listening, always the one who shows up, and the other person always seems to be going through something, always a little too busy, always taking, the dynamic will start to feel extractive. The driver of this derailment is one sneaky habit that, if left unchecked for long enough, will destroy a friendship. Non-reciprocity. If you've ever found yourself inexplicably frustrated with a friend, despite the length of your friendship, how much others love them, or how nice they are to everyone else, then there's a good chance non-reciprocity is to blame. Here are three signs that it's affecting your friendship. 1. Interactions in the friendship are zero sum. The first wheel to fly off in a friendship is usually how they show up for you. Someone who never reaches out at all is easy to label a bad friend because that level of one-sidedness is obvious. This is precisely why people often feel confused or even guilty when a friendship starts to feel toxic, even though interactions aren't totally one-sided. Your friend does reach out. You do talk regularly. There is interaction. So what's the problem? What many fail to realize in these scenarios is that zero-sum interactions can hurt just as much as one-sided ones. Consider, for instance, a friend who texts when they've had a terrible day and need to vent. You listen for an hour over FaceTime. Then 2 weeks later, you're going through something difficult and reach out, and they reply with a few sympathetic words before steering the conversation back to themselves. They surface when they need support. They go quiet when you do. Alternatively, consider the friend that's always brutally honest with you when it suits them. They can easily point out red flags in your relationship or tell you that you're being too sensitive. However, when they're doing something you know is a mistake, suddenly they'd rather you just be supportive than give them critical feedback. Their honesty is selective. It flows in the direction that benefits them. In each case, the interaction exists. The key detail to note, however, is that it always tilts in their favor. A 2009 study notes friendship reciprocity is one of the most meaningful indicators of social support above and beyond simply having more friends or more frequent contact. Using the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent Health, the researchers found that reciprocated friendships were associated with stronger school belonging, which in turn independently predicted academic performance. What the research makes clear is that it's not the quantity of interaction that matters, but whether the exchange is mutually beneficial. When this reciprocity is absent, your body may notice it before your mind does. Conversations that should feel stimulating will start to feel like a stress test. You leave interactions feeling depleted rather than restored. Over time, you'll begin feeling resentment, but without the sense of a clear cause. And because nothing is overtly wrong, you may even feel guilty for questioning the friendship. However, the mechanism is straightforward. A relationship that consistently costs you more than it gives back will feel laborious. Number two, their boundaries take precedence over yours. Given how popular it has become in self-help spheres, hearing someone use the term boundaries is often enough to signal apparent psychological sophistication. Someone who sets boundaries is self-aware. Someone who enforces them is brave. By this logic, a person who carefully protects their time and energy is doing something admirable and healthy. But setting boundaries, or even just using language that sounds related to boundaries, doesn't automatically mean a friendship is psychologically safe. Just as boundaries can make a relationship, they can also break one. And when they do break, asymmetry is usually to blame. Addressing asymmetrical boundary setting can be hard in the moment, as many fear being labeled as insensitive or toxic for exposing the behavior for what it is. Worse, noticing the dynamic can be just as hard, as it often takes time to become clear. Imagine, for example, that your friend makes it clear that they need space when they're stressed, and that they don't want to talk through their problems until they're ready. As a good friend, you respect that. However, a few weeks later, when you go quiet during a hard stretch, they take it personally. By contrast, imagine a friend who has firm boundaries around their personal time. They'll cite this boundary often, frequently declining plans whenever they aren't in the mood. But whenever they need your time or energy, they expect you to be available without question. The issue in both cases is that, despite the boundaries being valid, their benefits are limited because they only run in one direction. This is what researchers call boundary dissolution, an experience most people have encountered firsthand. A 2008 study from the Journal of Emotional Abuse defines boundary dissolution as the loss of psychological distinctiveness between individuals, or the confusion of interpersonal roles. The author is direct about its consequences. The breakdown of appropriate limits between individuals significantly increases the risk for emotional harm in a relationship. Notably, the operative word is appropriate. Boundaries are meant to be mutual protections, structures that help both people feel safe and respected. When they only function to regulate one person's experience of the friendship, they've been distorted into something else. Pay close attention to when the boundaries in your friendship are invoked, as well as to whose needs they consistently serve. If their limits are treated as non-negotiable, while yours are treated as soft suggestions, those aren't boundaries at all. They're rules. And living inside someone else's unspoken rulebook, while your own needs go unacknowledged, will establish you as the less important person in the dynamic. This next article is about adverse childhood experiences. It's from Wendy B. Smith, PhD, and it's titled, Child Neglect is Devastating to the Sense of Self. Too many children blame themselves for parental neglect. Key points. Neglect is understudied, yet it is the most common form of maltreatment. Neglect should not be confused with poverty. Children who have experienced neglect have high rates of suicidal ideation and illicit drug use. Young children often think they are neglected because of something bad about themselves. Neglect is the most commonly reported type of child maltreatment, affecting more than 1 in 7 U.S. children at some point in their lives, and yet it is the least studied type of childhood adversity. It is associated with a wide range of long-term negative health, mental health, and developmental outcomes. Some studies have found that quality of life in adulthood was lower for those who experienced emotional abuse and neglect than for those who were physically or sexually abused. From a study from Lippert and Nemeroff in 2023 and Strathern and others in 2020. Neglect is often confused or conflated with poverty, sometimes leading to inappropriate child welfare interventions or child removals when the problem is apparent with financial or housing difficulties, rather than a matter of intentional or unthinking neglect. Severe neglect and growing up in extreme poverty are both associated with disruptions to brain maturation and delays in cognitive development. But the dynamics and effects of child neglect are complex and damaging in ways that go beyond the harms of economic circumstances alone. The definition of child neglect as a reason for state intervention varies from state to state, though there is a broad agreement that it is the failure to adequately respond to the needs of a child. States place emphasis on a lack of supervision, exposure to unsafe conditions or people, or a lack of food, safe shelter, or medical attention. A few states with more expansive definitions include emotional neglect and failure to seek or get treatment for emotional problems. Too often, neglect includes failure to meet the entire list of children's physical and emotional needs, as I learned from the former juvenile offenders I interviewed for my book, Before Their Crimes, What We're Misunderstanding About Childhood Trauma, Youth Crime, and the Path to Healing. The painful recollections of neglect were almost always associated with parents caught up in drug addiction. Joshua's mother developed an addiction after she moved in with a new boyfriend who was a cocaine addict. He offers a poignant picture of the disastrous turn his life took when he was 7 years old. We went from a really nice neighborhood to living in some of the worst projects. And from then on, my mom was very neglectful. She spent her time locked in the bedroom with her new man. My brother and I had to take care of ourselves and cook for ourselves. My mom never washed our clothes. We always had dirty clothes. We had to wash them in the bathtub with a bar of soap. Sometimes we didn't have food. We would jump the fence behind the project to the fields next door where they grew cauliflower and broccoli. We'd boil it and eat it. Joshua started drinking at 14 and turned to methamphetamine soon after. He contemplated and made an aborted attempt at suicide. Eventually, he joined a gang. The people I interviewed were living testaments to the fact that neglect and abuse are often interwoven in children's lives, occurring simultaneously and inseparably. Despite the co-occurrence of neglect with physical or sexual abuse, neglect and emotional abuse have been found to predict greater severity of depression, even after controlling for physical and sexual abuse. Researchers have found elevated rates of suicidal ideation and higher rates of illicit drug use and underage alcohol use among youth who have experienced neglect. And I saw this myself in my 29 interviewees. The physical facts of neglect are hard on the body, potentially including impingement on neurobiological development. But there's also a powerful impact on mental health and the child's developing sense of self and the world. Neglected children see and feel the lack of care from the adults closest to them. It is a piercing experience of being unloved. As with other forms of abuse that occur early in life, before the self is fully developed, before children can easily distinguish the meaning of the behavior of others, they most often attribute the reason or cause of ill treatment to something bad or lacking or unlovable about themselves. The recollection and unpacking of early experiences of neglect with a trusted, caring adult in a safe space can make room for boundaries to become clearer and allow the self to flourish and healing to take place. This next article is titled The Best Ways to Begin Again, The Best Way to Begin Something New in Love, Work, and Life by Psychology Today contributors. Feeling depressed, anxious, or bored? Looking for new friends? Coping with loss, healing from a breakup, or searching for your life's purpose? Look for solutions to these disparate problems, and you're likely to see one suggestion appear again and again. Try something new. There's good reason for this. Psychology and neuroscience both make it clear that novel experiences help us stay sharp, adapt to change, manage stress, connect with others. The list goes on. The human brain is a dynamic, powerful organ, primed to respond to novelty. Indeed, regular exposure to new things is a known driver of neuroplasticity, the brain's capacity to grow and evolve over the lifespan. But starting something totally new, even if it's ultimately rewarding, is often easier said than done. Being a beginner usually means making mistakes, asking dumb questions, even failing outright. All big asks in a culture that venerates wonder kinds and overnight success stories. And that's to say nothing of the time, energy, and patience that most new endeavors require, but that many of us struggle to maintain. These challenges aren't insubstantial. They're often much more easily conquered than we fear, especially if we do our best to embrace the uncertainty and treat setbacks and false starts as useful data rather than personal failings. If you're ready to leave your comfort zone and finally pick up whatever you've been putting off, start here. When Yulia Vladovska left her corporate IT career at age 45 and enrolled at Accademia Carrara in Bergamo, Italy, to pursue an MFA in painting, she surprised everyone, including herself. Yet the decision wasn't as impulsive as it appeared. She thrived in a corporate environment centered around logic and precision, but I'd always felt like there was something inside me that wasn't really being explored. Her career necessitated frequent moves, and when she landed in Italy, ready for another new adventure, everything converged. At some point, you realize you're in the right place at the right time, and you have to do the right thing. She'd always had an artistic streak, sketching and coloring in her free time. But at the academia, Vladovska found herself surrounded by pupils half her age, but seemingly light years ahead in knowledge and skill. "I had to give up my old identity and go back to being a total beginner," she says. Sometimes that meant publicly failing, not just in front of her classmates, but her three teen sons. Yet the latter was surprisingly rewarding. "My children were used to seeing me in a specific role," she says. "I want to show them you can change whenever you want, and you might feel much better when you do. I hope that's been liberating for them." How to be a better beginner. You get to live this phase only once. Approaching it deliberately and with an experimenter's mindset can help make sure you enjoy it. By Alice Boyce, PhD. Jan is ready for a new challenge. She recently moved from a bustling city to a small town, famed for its outdoorsy culture, and she wants to take advantage of the new terrain and start mountain running. She's already been practicing on a treadmill and even found a local running group that advertises itself as beginner-friendly. She's excited to start, yet at the same time, overwhelmed, nervous, and deeply unsure of herself. Many people view being a beginner only through a lens of discomfort, fixing on the confusion, frustration, anxiety, and self-doubt that, yes, they'll likely experience. Too often, though, they forget that being a beginner at any experiential pursuit, training for a new career, taking up a new skill, or even starting a new relationship, is a uniquely rich phase, one often characterized by newbie gains and joyous self-discovery. We only get to experience the beginner phase once. So rather than rush through it, we might as well learn to enjoy it. These six tips could help. 1. Don't try to be invisible. Beginners often seek not to stand out. They want to make their newbie mistakes quietly, unnoticed. However, this approach can hinder actual progress, both because it makes them less likely to take risks and because it robs them of the benefits of social support. Other people make learning easier. Letting go of a desire to be invisible allows you to seek out people who you can ask questions of when you're stuck, or look to role models who can help give you a realistic perception of what to expect. When you go under the radar, you cut yourself off from these supports. Value progress more than you value hiding your mistakes. Beginners by nature can't avoid asking questions or trying things that will seem silly in retrospect because they don't yet know what they don't know. 2, enjoy your newbie gains. Weightlifters coin the term newbie gains to describe the rapid increase in both muscle and strength that novice lifters tend to experience. In strength training, newbie gains are physiological and observable. But newbie gains can happen in other pursuits too, even if they're not always as readily noticeable. We think we'll always remember what being a beginner felt like, but inevitably we don't. Being able to look back on it has value, so preserve it. Keep a few notes. Record a few videos talking about your inner experiences, achievements, and struggles. Narrate the journey, if only for the future you. Today's struggles become tomorrow's stories. Imagine yourself at a more accomplished stage, looking back on where you are now. In retrospect, you'll be proud of the version of you who muddled through your clueless phase. What feels messy now will feel impressive later. 3, embrace the abundance of resources aimed at beginners. Search for tips on almost any skill and you'll find far more aimed at beginners than at any other stage. When you're farther along, this can be frustrating, but at this stage, it's a powerful advantage. More experienced people often delight in sharing their knowledge and passion with newcomers, giving you a wealth of resources to draw from. Be mindful, though, that these resources can create the impression that your learning journey is less aesthetic or streamlined than it should be. Try to let those worries go as best you can. We like to be efficient, but efficiency can only come after skill building, a process that is clumsy and repetitive by design. 4, remember, you're not a beginner at learning. Even during an honest-to-God first attempt, you're never truly a blank slate. You know what the learning cycle feels like, what it feels like to pass through the various stages, and what it feels like to finally succeed. Whatever you're trying now might not be close to the hardest thing you've ever accomplished. Putting this new journey in the context of all those you've completed then can be an endless source of self-knowledge. Which learning methods work for you, even if they're challenging? Where do you typically get stuck? Do you have a tendency to self-sabotage? Tracking patterns and using personalized methods that have worked for you in the past don't just help you avoid likely pitfalls. They help reinforce the idea that success is possible. After all, you've done it before. 5, limit low-quality learning. In the age of short-form video, it's tempting to think we can learn well from passively consuming slick content. But while those resources can help orient us to what we have to learn, they rarely build the deep knowledge, skills, or experience we desire. Learning that feels easy is often a sign that nothing is going into your brain. Low-quality learning can distort our perception of our progress in two opposite ways. It can make us think our knowledge is deeper than it is. Watching charismatic instructors who excel at explanation or repetitive passive viewing can make us confuse following along with understanding. Conversely, since we can put a lot of time into passive learning without achieving much, this can lead to wrongly perceiving ourselves as not having the aptitude to achieve a deeper understanding. 6. Cultivate an experimenter's mindset. We all know someone who looks at everything as an opportunity to experiment. Some experiments work and some don't. But these people never seem to get discouraged. They just try again. That unfazed quality is central to what I call an experimenter's mindset, and it's a valuable prerequisite for trying anything new. Once you develop it, it spreads to other areas of your life, becomes a source of resilience, and helps keep you mentally agile. Try these tips if you'd like to improve your own experimenter's mindset. Engage with a community of experimenters. Most people don't operate with an experimenter's mindset. To learn from others' thinking patterns and receive encouragement, join an experimentation-oriented community that interests you. Desensitize yourself to missing a reward. We've all heard the stories of inventors who made hundreds of unsuccessful attempts at an invention before their breakthrough. An experimenter's mindset requires being relatively unbothered when experiments don't work. If that's not your natural response, it's a skill you'll need to build, at least to an extent. Try things you expect not to work. We often have biases that prevent us from attempting new approaches, particularly those that seem like long shots. True experimenters try things they fully expect not to work, because sometimes they do. Poke at a goal repeatedly until you succeed. We often unconsciously expect to succeed right away, and we get discouraged when we don't. But not being able to crack that nut quickly doesn't mean you never will, and each time you revisit a goal, your odds of success increase exponentially. Test the part that's unknown first. Say you want to create something technical. Some aspects of that project might be very familiar from your having done similar things before. Don't build those parts before you test the parts you're unsure about. The same applies outside of tech. Say you're considering meal prepping for the week. If the biggest unknown isn't about efficiency, but whether your family will actually want to eat the meal prepped food, test that first. Experiment regularly. An experimenter's mindset isn't something you can switch on and off when it's convenient. If you want it to be available, you have to use it regularly. The mental attitude of, I wonder if that might work, or I wonder how that works, and similar curious questioning, once turned on, will tend to permeate your life. Try things without proof that they worked for others. In an age of video tutorials and internet reviews, some folks are unwilling to try anything they don't already know works. Needing this type of certainty undercuts an experimenter's mindset. If you're comfortable in your life, you might consider an experimenter's mindset as merely a nice to have. But it's more than that. It's a source of resilience. There will likely be times in your life when you need an experimenter's mindset to get out of a jam. For example, if your industry is changing quickly and you need to adapt, or you need to cope with a stressor like a job loss, or perhaps you need to help your child navigate a challenging time they're experiencing, or navigate a challenging time you're experiencing yourself. An experimenter's mindset can help you stay flexible and keep trying instead of feeling stuck. Remember, the beginner phase for any activity happens only once. Instead of rushing it, treat it as a unique experience. Imagine looking back. How do you want to remember how you met today's challenges? How can you create a narrative that helps you feel proud of yourself now and doesn't demand being manicured or optimized? What do you hope to learn about yourself? Relish the richness of being a beginner instead of wishing your newness away. Alice Boyce, PhD, is the author of The Anxiety Toolkit and The Healthy Mind Toolkit. This next article is about intelligence. It's by Mark Travers, PhD. The three lazy habits that actually signal intelligence. What looks like the opposite of productivity often signals cognitive sophistication. Key points. Individuals with higher intelligence tend to show less brain activation when performing cognitive tasks. Individuals with higher intelligence show sleep patterns linked to more effective cognitive processing. In many cases, choosing not to react is a sign of emotional intelligence, not indifference. Most of us have a rigid mental image of what an intelligent person looks like. They're polished, habitually organized, quick on their feet, always on top of things, the kind of person who color codes their calendar, replies to emails instantly, and always thrives under pressure. Yet, as compelling and popular as this mental image is, it's also inaccurate. This version of intelligence is, beyond being unrealistic, totally unsustainable. Human cognition doesn't work like a machine that can run at full capacity indefinitely. In reality, people who are genuinely intelligent understand that their mental, physical, and emotional resources are finite. If they really want to perform well over the long term, they know that they have to protect those resources carefully. From the outside, though, this can look a little strange. Sometimes it even looks like laziness. Below are three such lazy habits that are, in fact, backed by research on intelligence. 1. Avoiding hard work. This habit seems almost contradictory. How could an intelligent person avoid hard work? Isn't that their precise modus operandi? But as soon as we look closer, it becomes clear that this isn't actually concerned with work ethic. It's about avoiding unnecessary effort. Taking shortcuts, automating tasks, or choosing the path of least resistance is often framed as cutting corners. In reality, it can reflect something much more sophisticated, efficiency. A seminal 2009 review published in Neuroscience and Biobehavioral Reviews explored what's known as the neural efficiency hypothesis of intelligence. This theory suggests that individuals with higher intelligence tend to show less brain activation when performing cognitive tasks. While some might misconstrue this as a sign of disengagement, it's actually because their brains are working more efficiently than others. Intelligent people succeed by getting to the same answer as other hard workers only by using fewer resources. For instance, imagine two people solving the same problem at work. One painstakingly goes through every possible step, double-checking everything along the way. The other notices a pattern, skips redundant steps, and, by analyzing their own workflow, arrives at the solution in half the time. Someone who didn't know better might say that the second person looks like they're not trying very hard. But in reality, they've simply recognized the most efficient route. This is why so-called lazy individuals are often the ones who come up with better systems. They automate repetitive tasks. They question inefficient workflows. They look for leverage. What gets labeled as laziness is often just the kind of systems-level thinking that prioritizes outcomes over effort for its own sake. 2. Sleeping or napping a lot. Few behaviors are more strongly associated with laziness than sleeping in or taking naps during the day. But neuroscience tells a very different story. In a 2015 study published in Scientific Reports, researchers examined the relationship between fluid intelligence and sleep patterns, specifically something called sleep spindles during an afternoon nap. These are bursts of brain activity that occur during certain stages of sleep, which are believed to contribute to memory consolidation and learning. The researchers found a positive association between fluid intelligence and the duration of these sleep spindles. In simple terms, this means that individuals with higher intelligence showed sleep patterns linked to more effective cognitive processing, even during naps. This challenges the long-standing cultural image of the tireless genius who works late into the night, sacrificing sleep in pursuit of productivity. In reality, high performers often do the opposite. They protect their sleep fiercely, and for good reason, too. They know that sleep is far from passive downtime. Sleep is an active, essential process that supports several instrumental components of our everyday functioning: memory consolidation, emotional regulation, creative problem solving, and complex reasoning. This is why when you're sleep deprived, your brain quite literally cannot function at full capacity. Your attention falters, your decision making worsens, and your emotional responses become harder to regulate. So when someone goes to bed early, wakes up late, or takes regular naps, don't immediately assume that they're merely being indulgent. For the intelligent, these habits are a deliberate investment in their cognitive performance, out of respect for their biological limits. 3, letting things slide. We tend to admire people who are constantly engaged, people who speak up, push back, and have something witty to say in response to every slight or inconvenience. By contrast, someone who shrugs things off, avoids conflict, or occasionally says, "I don't care," can come across as passionless and apathetic. However, the primary nuance that this interpretation glosses over is that in many cases, choosing not to react is a sign of emotional intelligence, not indifference. Emerging research, including a 2025 study published in Frontiers in Public Health, suggests that individuals with higher emotional intelligence are better at managing stress and regulating their emotions. The authors note that one of the key mechanisms behind this is something called psychological detachment, the ability to mentally disengage from stressors, especially outside of work. This ability is strongly linked to better mental health and overall well-being. Consider, for instance, two colleagues who receive a mildly critical comment from their manager. One of them spends the rest of their day ruminating. They replay the interaction over and over again in their head, feeling frustrated, maybe even drafting a defensive response. The other acknowledges it, extracts the useful feedback, disregards what doesn't resonate with them, and moves on. To an outside observer, the second person might seem disengaged or overly passive. But in reality, they've made a calculated decision, withdrawing from something that isn't worth their time or emotional energy. That's the essence of choosing your battles. Not every frustration deserves a response. Not every slight requires correction. And not every problem needs to be solved immediately. Letting things slide in this context is about knowing your priorities. And for intelligent people, this is a non-negotiable means of preserving their mental resources for what truly matters. This last article is under the category Parenting by Susan Newman, PhD. It's titled, "Can a Pet Fill a Sibling Role for an Only Child?" Studies show furry companions are developmental gifts to only children. Key points. For young children, having a pet can help with social and emotional development. 75% of all children age 7 and older have pets, with ownership highest in single-child households. Pet ownership has been shown to promote empathy, kindness, and sharing in only children. Concern about an only child's development growing up without a sibling remains an undercurrent for some. But as evidence mounts that siblings are not essential, more people are realizing that a child does not need a sibling to learn how to share, to be respectful of others, and to be caring, compassionate, and responsible. The new science highlights how only children thrive. No sibling, an imagined deficit. "You got me the brother I always wanted," screeched Neha's 6-year-old only child, when her mother put a puppy in her daughter's outstretched arms. For most children, requesting a human sibling is a stage. Some kids can be fierce and relentless for a while. Others never ask. That leaves it to parents to decide not only if they want to have multiple children, but also how to break it to their only child if they don't want to when the subject comes up. As far-fetched as it may seem, for many only child parents, a pet is part of the solution. It may sound sort of nuts, but I really think having a pet fills the perceived sibling void, one mother told me. It's actually not crazy at all when you think about how much we value our pets. According to a Pew Research Center survey, about half of U.S. pet owners say their pets are as much a part of their family as a human member. Among owners with one pet, 69% have dogs and 23% have cats. That would account for much of the research being focused on dogs. Developmental pluses of pets. Study after study supports the benefits of pet ownership for children. An investigation published in Pediatric Research found that for preschoolers, a third of whom were only children, having a dog and interacting with it through play and family dog walking may be important mechanisms for facilitating young children's social-emotional development, according to Wendin. Other researchers reported that parents used a greater proportion of emotion and mental state language with their children when playing with their pet dog than with a lifelike toy. The researchers suggest the presence of a household pet may be one context used to promote conversations about emotions and mental states. They concluded that childhood pet ownership promotes empathy and pro-social behavior resulting from parent-child conversations. Similarly, another study observed parent-child interactions, how feelings and affection were expressed, as well as self-image, contact with peers, and cooperation among 3- and 5-year-olds, half with dogs at home, half with no pets. The research team found that contact with dogs at home during early childhood is related to more advanced social development in both boys and girls, according to Duendas. When Australian researchers looked specifically at only children with pets and only children without pets, their findings were consistent with other pet-related studies. Reporting in the Journal of Pediatrics, they note a significant difference between the two groups. Only children who had pets displayed stronger social behaviors such as kindness, empathy, and sharing than only children who did not have a pet, according to Christian. These findings are consistent with what my husband and I and many other parents of singletons observed. We witnessed my son's dog not only filling his empty time, but also providing a living being to worry about, take care of, and be kind and gentle toward. The pet gave him someone to snuggle with, and conversely, to boss around, as siblings do. His dog taught him a lot about being responsible. Reality check. That's not to say that parents aren't also responsible for a pet's care. More often than you bargain for, the reality is you may end up taking the dog for walks, cleaning the kitty litter or the pet's cage, or feeding that new human in your household. But the pet you choose clearly has the potential to be more than worth your sacrifice in terms of your only child's development. The research strongly indicates that a pet could be the perfect addition to your family. Although many of the studies on this topic focus on dogs, the chosen pet could be a cat, a gerbil, or another animal. Don't be surprised if you hear your child, like Neha's daughter, calling his pet my brother or my sister. The mother's statements were made during the interview investigation for my book, Just One, The New Science and Secrets and Joys of Parenting an Only Child, by Susan Newman. Thank you for joining us for a reading of Psychology Today. Our broadcast is for informational purposes only, and any suggestions should always be discussed with your healthcare providers. This program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org. Or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Tracy. Thank you for listening.